Welcome to another episode of the Property Nomads podcast. And today we're joined by Anthony Hunter, who has gone from wanting to play loads of cricket and being very sporty into being a property powerhouse through Chant Property with his brother. So Anthony, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to come on and speak to you about all things property and business. So I love this type of thing. I like talking. So yeah.
We're going to leave no stone unturned, I think, as we said just off the air before we came on. It's going to be a very sort of nice, open, honest conversation and a touch on a few things as well. But for people that are listening to the podcast that don't necessarily know who you are, have never heard of you or Chant Properties before, just give us a little bit about your background and how you come to starting the business.
So, first and foremost, it's me and my brother. So it is a family affair in that sense, but a lot of people are not keen on working with family. But me and my brother have a very good relationship when it comes to business. But it started, I suppose, Chris bought his first property when he was 19. Chris is my brother. He bought another one when he was about 22, just from savings, just from working really hard, living at home, doing everything he could himself. So fitting the kitchens, etc. himself. With my dad. I jumped on board and bought my first property when I was 22. And then we did a bit of a property course and ended up kind of accelerating it from there. We didn't really know that through property there was an opportunity for people like us to acquire a set level of properties. We kind of thought 10 properties would be a great pension pot. It might take us 20, 30 years, but we'll just keep chipping away. We'll work really hard. We'll save as much as we can. So that was the business model, so to speak. Chucking it back before that, my brother was a HGV mechanic. He wanted to go in the Royal Engineers, but he didn't get the grades for it. So he ended up getting an apprenticeship in mechanicing. Chris, I don't even know the actual technical term. Is it called mechanicing?
Let's just say mechanics. That sounds better.
I just used to call him a grease monkey, which I didn't like, but he failed his way through school, didn't have a great time in school, and then just worked really hard. Like, he put his hand to anything. He did a bit of fencing, a bit of tarmacking, like really, really proper grafter. For me, I had more of an illusion of being a cricketer, which was never something. It's something I spoke about relatively openly recently. I was probably in denial of the fact that I wanted to be, but was embarrassed at the fact that I wasn't good enough. So I've kind of owned that a little bit more now. When I realised that was going down the pan, I thought I'd do a sports degree because I didn't know what else to do. Kept me close to sport, meant that I could go to uni and get pissed for 3 years and have a good time, which I did. Got sports. I went out to Australia, played cricket in Australia. Really realised how bad I was compared to the Australians. And then after that, I got a sales job. And then from there, I left. Well, I didn't leave that job actually. I acquired the company 2 years ago. So that's a bit of a whistle stop tour. That's kind of where it started and where it is now.
That's pretty cool. So, apart from being a bad cricketer, as in your own words there, and doing a sports degree, fun at university, getting pissed, we've all been there and done that. You know, we'll hold our hands up to it. So what flipped the switch then? Because you said that you had this sort of very relaxed sort of pension pot plan, and then out of nowhere you're now kicking ass basically. So how does that come about?
But probably in quite a conventional route that a lot of people will have found themselves taking, which is self-education now is huge. And I was really fortunate that I would have fell into self-education and self-development at some point, but my first boss at my sales role made me read a book by a guy called Zig Ziglar, who is like the Don. I absolutely love Zig Ziglar. And the first like hour of listening to it, I thought, this guy is mental. I cannot listen to this. But I stuck with it and I really enjoyed it. And I suppose there was a little glimmer in there of a different mindset and more of an abundance mindset, I suppose you could say. there's just a little bit of a glimmer in there that kind of suggested that you can have a little bit more than you think you can. So when I moved on from that, I fell into Rich Dad Poor Dad. I read that, and that kind of created a bit of a spark for me, like it has with millions of people. And then a friend tagged me in a property event, kind of taking the piss, because he knew that I'd been reading some books. And I went along to it, and it was this whole philosophy that you can start to acquire property without having any money. And it sounds like a bit of a myth, doesn't it? It sounds like a bit of a, surely not. So we sat there relatively skeptical. And then I started meeting people that had done it, and I started to see some case studies. I met such an inspiring guy called Mark Dalton, who a lot of people will be aware of, who went from a market trader in Luton to where he is today, which is a seriously successful property investor. So I identified with him, and I thought, if somebody that normal can kind of achieve those things, then what's stopping us? So it was just a mindset shift and a hanging around with the right people, I think.
What things were you skeptical about when going back onto that training you were talking about? What things were you skeptical about?
Well, so this is the whole working class mantra. I mean, I don't believe in classes, but if you were to put us into a sector, dad worked really hard, mum worked part time, kind of self employed, doing her thing, and brought up in an okay area, just very, very normal. But when you're in that little bubble, you're always taught things like don't always believe everything you hear, and if it's too good to be true, it probably is. All those types of things. So it was like a little. It just felt like a secret. Like it felt like why did I not know that you could buy property using somebody else's money? And if I didn't know, and loads of other people didn't know, it probably wasn't true. So it was kind of it was just that whole thing where. I'd never met anybody in my life. We had a guy that was a family friend called Aaron Curry, who's done amazing things in property, and he's got a fantastic property business. But I didn't know that's the route that Aaron had taken. I just saw Aaron as somebody that was seriously wealthy and got into property, and he got in at the right time. That's always the thing that you hear. So there was loads of kind of skepticism there. I just didn't think it was possible.
And then I imagine it's similar boat, you know, here, very similar sort of start with myself and my business partner, Aaron, as well. Is once you've done the first one and then that refinance comes in, you kind of go, ooh, wow, this shit works. And then you just want to do more.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. And as your confidence grows, I suppose the belief grows alongside it, doesn't it? So the whole philosophy of an angel investor for me was probably one of the scariest things that I mean, I'm happy to lose, not happy, but I'm okay with losing some of my own money. Losing somebody else's money, I would rather, honestly, I would battle till the end to get them back. It didn't sit right with me that because of my lack of experience, it didn't sit that well with me that I was using other people's money to buy property at the very beginning. But I suppose that's why we were offering 15%. And as risk is high, so is reward. And I understand that now. Back then, I didn't understand that. So if somebody's thinking of getting into property and they're thinking of angling some money off somebody and they are offering 12, 13, 14, 15%, especially in this climate, then their investor will be aware that it's a high risk, high reward strategy. You don't know that stuff when you first start.
No, that's a very key lesson, as well as you say, it's risk and reward are pretty much work in tandem. And you mentioned a point about the right time to get into property. I think it's always the right time to get into property. There's just different opportunities at different stages of the market. That's my philosophy.
Yeah, well, there's a saying, isn't there? The right time to get into property was 20 years ago.
True.
The best time to get into property was 20 years ago. The next best time is now. So just the whole tree philosophy, isn't it? You want to plant a tree 20 years ago, you can't. So you may as well plant one now.
Yeah, absolutely. And start with the end in mind. So, that's crucial as well. So when you started, two things on that. How did you get into business with your brother? What made you decide to do that? And then what plans did you set out? What's your end goal of doing property?
Well, I got into property with my brother because we brought very different skill sets. So we could not be more opposite. If I'd have gone out and done this on my own, because I said to Chris, I'm going to do it and I'm going to commit to it. There is a chance that instead of buying the amount of property that we've bought now, I might have bought triple the amount. But there is also quite a big likelihood that I'd be bankrupt. Whereas if with Chris, Chris wouldn't have bought, he'd have probably bought maybe one more property over the last 8 years. He's too far the other way. So it's like with our valuations, I'll come back and say it's easy worth 100 and he'd say it's worth 80 and usually it's worth 90. So that the relationship works quite well together. So it just seems savvy and I don't know, like I've always felt like with me and Chris aren't a close kind of in terms of family. I would do anything for him because he's my brother. But example, today it's his birthday. I like sending him a card and a present. I just texted him saying birthday, and it was my birthday a couple of weeks ago. And again, he won't do the same. So we've got a strange relationship. But we kind of said if we're going to succeed, it'd be better to do it together than do it separately. I would, if one of us succeeded and the other one didn't, we'd just end up dragging them with us anyway. So, yeah, it seemed like the right thing to do. And it's probably been the best decision we've made.
Yeah, it's always easier to work with someone than work on your own, because then you can always bounce ideas off each other and you've got a bit of yin and you've got a bit of yang, haven't you? So it makes sense. In terms of, again, starting with the end in mind, you said you've been started at doing some training and many people are going to be listening to podcasts, reading books, etc. And then they'll create a plan. So what did you have in mind for when you first started?
You don't even want to know. I was buying yachts, helicopters. I remember coming out of that course on the first day saying, we're going to buy 1,000 properties in 10 years. So it's changed though. It's changed over time. And I think as you start to acquire more assets and you start to kind of build wealth, I suppose you could say that the thing that you don't get taught at the start is that security starts to creep in a little bit. So you start thinking things like, I've worked so hard for this period here. Is it secure? So it's again, Zig Ziglar, the fear of loss is greater than the desire for gain. And that's something that always sticks with you. I mean, this is sales tactic essentially, but so looking forward, I don't want to be as highly geared as I originally wanted to be. And I don't want the number of properties as I used to want. So we actually want half the number of properties that we originally set out to get. And I think if somebody says, or you said to somebody, how many properties do you want? Or what do you want? And they say 100 properties, they haven't worked it out. It seems to be like a round number. It sounds pretty cool. Like I got 100 properties. It sounds really cool, but what does that actually mean? So for us in property, we would like our buy-to-let portfolio to be at a level where it can sustain and maintain 2 members of staff. We can look at paying down big chunks of debt each year to get our portfolio down to 50% over the next kind of 15 years. We want to be at that 50% level. And enough to pay me and Chris, we've said $6,000 a month, which sounds like an obscene amount, but we forget the fact we've never taken a penny out of this portfolio to this day. We always seem to find other ways of generating and making income. So that figure came from kind of a what couldn't you spend figure. So it's not a financial freedom figure. Some people's financial freedom figure might be that high, but it seemed to be, it's a long-term strategy for us, property. And it took us a little while to kind of understand that and accept that. But business is fun. And I think it might be Alan Sugar that says that he does property for his wealth and business for fun. So I kind of feel the same.
Yeah, I agree. And I think having that long-term perspective of property is crucial, because it is the way that you perceive it and the way that I perceive it, it's very long-term wealth accumulation that doesn't happen overnight. And letting the economy allow doing what it needs to do, up, down, up, down, up, down, having sensible security and gearing, it's figuring out it's about figuring out all that. There's a lot more to it than just the bricks and mortar and there's a property, there's my rent. There is a lot more to it behind the scenes.
Yeah, no, I mean, so one of the things that I would rather have, just using round numbers, I would rather have 50 properties at 50% loan to value than I would have 100 properties at 75-80% loan to value. Now, a lot of people would say that, yeah, but you'll have 50 properties worth of capital appreciation as the market goes up, so you'll miss out on that. But there's two things. I'm in the northeast of England. You're never going to get huge capital appreciation anywhere. And that's not the strategy for that business. That business is a cash flow business. That's what it's for. It's to generate income. And the best chance of that sustaining a good level of income for the longest period of time is if things like the market can't dictate where the income is coming. It means you can get more of a consistent level. So that's the reason that we've decided to do that. And rightly or wrongly, who knows, if the market doubles in the northeast in 10 years, then I might have to eat my words, but we'll see.
And I think it's a fair enough point, because what people aren't realizing, and again, you know, if you've been in property for 20, 30, 40 years, you would have seen a couple of cycles. Whereas if you've been in property for 6, 7, 8, 9 years, you might remember sort of the effects of that 2007, 2009 crash. But what will happen again, and it will happen again, is there will be a massive crash again in the housing market. So, yeah, having a gearing of 50%, as you say, it doesn't matter if your house is worth £100,000 or a pound. If your rent's still coming in and you're still making £300 a month, it don't really matter what it's worth, but you have to sort of play the cycle, don't you?
Yeah, and that's it. And if you've got different strategies for different cycles, then you can maximize that. If you're in a kind of a boom market and you're doing lots of flips, or if you're in a kind of the other side of the cycle and you're acquiring lots of cash flow, then it's just about doing the right things at the right time, I think. But that business, that Chant model is a cash flow business, so that's what we need to make sure it stays.
So we just mentioned on the buy-to-let side, and that's one strategy. We also do sourcing. So give us a bit of insight into the other strategies that you do within Chant Properties.
So, again, flips. We'll probably, and a lot of people laugh at this, we are the worst flippers in history. We've bought flips and we just keep them. So all we end up doing is realising that we can get the money that we'd probably get on the flip on the refinance, and we can keep it and rent it out, so we end up keeping them. So we've got a bungalow we're flipping at the moment that doesn't work very well as a buy-to-let. So that sounds really risky. You should always do a flip with multiple exit strategies, but we've kind of forced our hand. We've just said we are never going to do a flip unless we actually put ourselves in a position to do one. And now the market's changed, so we might have to let it on like a service, at least to the council, for somebody that might be like disabled. I don't know. Chris came back and said, I found a guaranteed rent on with a disabled tenant. And I was like, oh God, we're going to end up keeping another flip. So we do dabble with that, but not very successfully. We've got a commercial building going through as well, which we can get into 5 flats. That's quite exciting. And then the sourcing business really, that really only started in November. And that probably came a little bit more out of frustration from other sourcing businesses. So we would tell a sourcing agent that we wanted a 3-bed ex-council house that needed a renovation in South Shields, South Tyneside. And we'd get sent a 2-bed new build flat on the quayside. And then I'd say, no, that's not what we're looking for. And then they'd send a new building in a different area where it was ready to go. We just basically what happened is we'd get a couple of emails, we'd read them, and then every time they sent a deal across, I just think it's going to be shit. It's not going to be what we're looking for. So I just started ignoring them, which is stupid, really. But so we just said that we picked up a bit of knowledge in business, and we probably start to understand business systems and processes, which means we can build the business relatively easily. And the other thing that we feel that we've become experts in is buy-to-let. So I said, why don't we set up a sourcing business with a capped number of clients for buy-to-let? It sounds really straightforward. It keeps things really simple. And it means we don't need any more additional marketing strategies. We don't need to change the way that we do anything in any real way. So we decided to set up like that and ask our clients what they're looking for, and then send them that they get a bit of a pledge that if we send them something that they have told us that they're not looking for, we'll source them a deal for free, which sounds bonkers, but why would you tell a sourcing agent exactly what you want and not get sent what you want? There has to be consequences for us for doing that and for not listening. And on the flip side of that, we've said that if we send you three deals that hit and match all of your criteria and you don't buy them, then you get a strike each time. And once you get three strikes, they're off the list. So I think it's a fairly... And the reason I think, or the reason I've mentioned that is because a lot of people will set up a sourcing business as a primary strategy because they're getting into property, they're trying to generate cash flow, and there's never anything wrong with that. That's a really good way of doing it. But we did a little bit of sourcing at the start. Now, the only thing that I would say is that when you're sourcing and you're relying on that income, you kind of do whatever you're told to do. Whereas we're sourcing from a slightly different position where we can dictate terms a little bit more, which feels good, and it feels like we can offer a better level of service like that as well. So yeah, the sourcing business is relatively new, but it's exciting.
I like what you've done there, because you've also taken out a key thing of almost desperation. Because as you say, if you're relying on that chunky money, and you know, anything can happen with sourcing. You'll have a great deal lined up, and then either, I don't know, maybe the valuer downvalues it, or someone spots something that's not right with the property, and then you're back to square one. Whereas if you're not reliant on that income, you're not as desperate. So that means, as you say, you can dictate terms and play to your own tune, can't you?
Yeah, well, like we want it to work, but without sounding too blasé, it doesn't matter if it doesn't. So I think with that attitude, I think that we've got 50 people on a list, and then we've got a waiting list essentially. So we're only sourcing to 50 people, and the rest are on a waiting list. And if you get your three strikes, you drop onto the waiting list, and somebody else drops on. So I think it creates, what we're trying to do is create a list of good investors that will buy what they say they will buy. And for me, that is better than having 1,000 investors on a list when 900 of them are never going to even invest in property. They've just clicked subscribe to your list, which is just a pain in the ass.
Yeah, too true. I remember things. Tim Ferriss was speaking about podcast numbers a while ago, and he was saying that, you know, it doesn't matter if you've got millions and millions of downloads. That's nice, but if no one ends up buying anything, so what's the point? If you've got 100 people that are going to buy every time, it makes life easier.
Yeah, it's it. Yeah, it's I suppose it's marketing, isn't it? Sales and marketing.
Yeah, but I'm probably the worst person in the world at that. I'm horrific. I'm horrific at that. I just think, if someone wants something, then, you know, they'll find a way of getting it done. Which again, it's kind of a not the best way to think about it, because a lot of it is, you know, you sat through training courses. Well, some of it is playing on those emotions to get you to want to do something. Well, that's not me. I'm the worst person at that.
I love sales, and I love the psychology of sales, and I'm heavily invested in learning about sales as well. There's a bookshelf there that'll have 20-30 sales books on it, and sales has changed over the years. So high pressure sales tactics, the old school buy it now or it goes up, all of those things in sales seem to have changed. People are a lot more savvy and a lot more aware of it now. So people are a lot more likely to spend money with people that they like, and they're a lot more likely to spend money if they don't feel like they're being sold to. But there's also that, there's a fine line in sales between encouraging somebody to spend money that they probably should spend or that they want to spend, or versus pressurizing somebody into spending money that they shouldn't or don't want to spend. So it's more like being an assistant buyer. It's like sitting next to somebody as opposed to sitting opposite somebody. You help them with the decision. And I think that's what good salespeople do.
Yeah, as with anything, it just comes down to karma, I think, same in any form of, you know, business. If you're helping someone to then create a win-win situation, happy days, no problem. If you're going to do it at someone else's cost, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot somewhere down the line.
Yeah, my business partner in the ventilation business always says that you can't do a bad deal with a good person.
Nice.
Which I quite like.
Nah, that's good. I like that. That's loads of wisdom on the episode. Love it. Absolutely love it. In terms of where you are now, so again, you've got a decent buy-to-let portfolio, happy days. You've started up the sourcing business. You just mentioned a ventilation business on the side. So in terms of moving forward, you've got your aims to work for. Do you think you're going to venture into any other strategies, or is it just a case of focusing on what you're doing, keep getting better every day until you've got to where you need to be?
Yeah, so I quite like, which sounds a little bit strange because I am quite, I like to take risks. Risks and uncertainty are things that I look for. But I also like to take risks that I know are worth taking. And I'm very aware that the things like HMOs are good strategies. Service accommodation can be a really good strategy. Well, service accommodation is more of a business than a property strategy. But there are loads of good strategies out there. But the bedrock of our strategy will always be buy to let. And I can put a 99% confidence on that. And there's a little pyramid that you'll see, that people will see flying around, which has got your buy to lets on the bottom, and then you work your way up and your commercials at the top. My appetite for HMO is pretty small. The property that I'm chopping up in, or due to chop up into five flats, would have lent itself really well to 2.5, maybe three, two HMOs and maybe a little minimo as well. But when I look at HMOs and when I look at the numbers in HMOs and you put them in a profit and loss alongside something like a buy-to-let, you've got to have a super HMO to get the same return on investment. When you look at things like turnover of tenants, getting in and fixing appliances, finding new tenants, void periods, all those types of things that you don't tend to get over a five-year period in a buy-to-let. So I just think I would never say it's a bad strategy because I know people doing exceptionally well through it. But when it comes to property, we will probably fluctuate between the buy-to-let consistently, and then we'll probably keep dropping into things like commercial to resi conversions. Chris quite likes old buildings. His goal is to renovate and sounds like chaos for me. It doesn't interest me, but grade one and churches and things like that. He wants to get those and restore those and put them into nice flats or properties and stuff like that. That's where Chris's ambition lies. That just sounds like a lot of regulation, a lot of paperwork for me. So... Yeah, so we'll dabble into different things, but I think we'll always we'll just continue to buy to lets the whole way, and that's just going to compound and compound and compound. So yeah, I think that answers the question.
No, definitely. As having got some planning for a client before for a grade 2 star listed building, yeah, I could definitely say it's a lot of time, a lot of visits, and a lot of paperwork. So leave that with Chris.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In terms of finding deals, you mentioned you're up in the Northeast, and you know, again, people that might be listening to this might be thinking about getting started in property and thinking, well, how do I find deals? How have you gone about that process? What do you do? And what do you do? Do you do anything that's different from what a lot of other people do when you come to finding deals?
Any successful investors and people that have done well in property do the same things. They just do different volumes of the same things, in my opinion. So, again, there's a good Mark Dalton said success leaves clues. So if you copy successful people, the likelihood is you'll become relatively successful. So for us, we have invested an awful lot of time in estate agents. Now, you will look and speak and hear things about estate agents in the sense that everyone will say, like, you don't get the best deals unless you go off market, or you've got to be getting off market properties. I agree that it has to be part of a strategy, but like any marketing strategy, you've got to have loads of different areas that you're attacking. And for me, estate agents have been the biggest and best source of below market value. And I'm not talking 10, 20%. I'm talking some properties we've got from estate agents that are 40, 50% below market value. And the reason for that is relationships, which sounds quite 90s sales cheesy, doesn't it? But I think that, I mean, we've got properties in scenarios where we aren't the highest bidder. Now, that tells you everything you need to know, that the estate agent wants to deal with us. They know that we're going to deliver on what we say we're going to deliver on. And I've got a decent sense of humour. I take the piss out of Chris quite a lot. So I think they quite like dealing with us. I think they're like, we'll drop into the office and have a bit of crack with them. So that's taken years, by the way. That's not something that happens overnight. When I first walked into an estate agency, one in South Shields, and I'd read a book that said I have to say I'm a property investor. So I walked in and said, my name's Anthony, I'm a property investor. And she said, no, you're not, where are your parents? But we've bought loads of deals off them. I reckon we've bought maybe 12, 15 properties off them now. So we worked on them and worked on them and worked on them. Sometimes it's about being in the right place at the right time. But if you go in trying to be this big, I'm a property investor, you need me more than I need you, you'll get nothing from them. We found the best way is, and I worked on the accent because I'm not from Newcastle. I used to say, I worked on it as in like pretended to be a Geordie, but I used to sit down and say, I'm not from here, can you help? And the response to that was so much better than, I'm a property investor and I've got money to spend on property right now. Because they just see an idiot walking in thinking, oh, we can get rid of that dodgy one that we can't sell. So I used to sit down with them and say, can you help me? And a decent person will say yes. Of course I can, and you work with them, let them understand that you know they're the expert in the area. We've just built really strong relationships. And a quick one, signs in windows. So every time we refurb a house, we have a big sign up, and all it says, nothing fancy, we buy houses like this, cash offer, guaranteed, call, and then a number. That's got us our most off-market deals.
Top man, that's great advice. And I was thinking, for anyone that's thinking of investing in the Northeast, probably not a good idea to walk in and go, why, hey, man?
And then start a conversation like that.
don't do that. And be careful where you mention our name as well. Got down quite well enough to them, but,
Anthony told me to do it.
yeah, exactly.
Whereabouts are you from originally?
So I was born in Scarborough. Lived in Scarborough. I was born in a little area of Scarborough called Osgoby, and moved to somewhere called Caton when I was about 10, maybe. Which is nice little areas, Caton. I moved from Scarborough when I was 18, so spent a lot of time in Scarborough.
Yeah, nice place. So building relationships with agents is very important. You mentioned the signs in the windows there. A common sort of misconception about sourcing agents is they're always going to keep the best deals for yourself. So if you get offered a great deal, 30-40% below market value, and you've got people on your sourcing list that want the same things, but you've got the capacity to buy it, how do you and Chris make that decision of, do you feed the sourcing side or do you take it on yourself? Or is it you're always going to do it for yourself first and then feed everyone else the rest?
Yeah, that sounds pretty, it sounds pretty tough, but yeah, there wouldn't be a discussion. If it hits our criteria, we buy it. And if the people that we source to don't like that, then they need to try and put themselves in our position and try and get those deals before us. That the reason you'll pay a sourcing agent is generally because you haven't got the time to go out and find the properties. So we would never, if there's a deal where we're getting all of our money back, that's never getting sourced unless we have got every single penny tied up and all of our contacts, all of our cards, everything's maxed out and we're in quite a fairly exposed position, but we'd be charging more for it because you're offering more, so you should charge more. People will disagree with that, but we've built our own portfolio and that always has to be the primary focus. I would never build somebody else's portfolio kind of over building ours, but we don't on our criteria, we don't offer things kind of that high. We'll just the max ROI we'll say is kind of 30% plus. there's none mentions of 40s and 50s and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think anybody would expect that.
No, that's why, as you said, managing expectations, because everyone comes into, you know, property with a different mentality and a different way of seeing things. You know, one thing I see on social media quite a bit is people chucking their toys out of the pram at paying sourcing fees. It's like, well, as you've just said, well, if you haven't got the time to do it, or someone has the ability to get better properties or better deals than you, then there's got to be a cost to that, surely.
Yeah, there does. And I think our relationships alone are worth the sourcing fee. We're now in the a nice position where Chris might get a text saying ABC, 123 ABC Streets came up. You've bought one, two streets away. Do you want this as well? That looks, and then let's say we get that text, we put it into a document, we source it on. That looks like 10 minutes work. And on the front end of it, it is. But the thing that you forget is that there's 5 years worth of relationship building. Yep. And thousands of other investors that were on their list that didn't get a text and didn't get a call. That's what you pay for when you're paying a sourcing agent.
Yeah, totally agree. Absolutely agree. We, you know, in order to grow our portfolio, that's what we do. We use sourcing agents because they seem to have, you know, better relationships, have access to better deals. So for us, it's a numbers game. No issues. That's how we look to grow ours, and that's just part of our strategy. Yeah, everyone's different.
We would have used us if we could have found a sourcing agent that passed us what we wanted, which sounds so simple, but if we could have found one that passed us what we wanted, we would have bought from them. And that's, I mean, if anybody is a sourcing agent listening to this in South Tyneside or West Newcastle, message us, because we are buying more property. And if you can send us only what we want, then we'd love to build a really good relationship with a sourcing agent. We'd be an amazing client if I do say so myself. We would tell them what they want, and if they offered it, we'd buy it. Simple as that. What else do you want from a sourcing contact?
Keeping business simple, just how it should be.
Yeah.
Do you find that people overcomplicate things too much from your experiences? Do you find that people sometimes overcomplicate things a bit too much, whether it's a sourcing client or an agent or a vendor?
I think that that's quite a, you could delve into that loads. I mean, vendors always think the houses are worth a lot more than they are. Estate agents want to get properties to sell from vendors, so they are dictated to by them, unless you've got a really strong agent with a really strong kind of brand and values that will say to the client, no, you either go with my price or you go elsewhere. So there is that side of things. But when it comes to buying property, you get too many ditherers. You get so many people that we have swooped in and got so many deals from people that have analysis paralysis, where they're thinking, oh, I said I'd only leave, I said I wanted 30% ROI, but I also said I only want to leave $7,000 in. This one's 32% ROI, but I've got to leave $8,000 in. So then they're kind of like, oh, it doesn't hit all of my criteria, I'm going to walk off. So when that seems to happen, then people will swoop in and get the deals before them. So people, I think people think too much when it comes to buying the first few properties. If you know exactly what you're looking for and it's pretty close, just get on with it, because people do that with deals again and again and again. And this is why we brought in that striking policy with the sourcing business, because I don't want to send something to somebody that they ask for three times and then not take action on it, because they're probably, if they get sent three deals that fit their criteria and they don't buy one, they're probably not going to buy anything. So it's committing. It's easier said than done, because there's a lot of fear. But when you're in the market of buy-to-let, and when you're in the lower end of the market, it's as low as your risks are ever going to get. As long as it's structurally sound, and as long as it hasn't got things like Japanese knotweed and all that kind of thing, if you're investing for the long term, and I'm talking 10, 15, 20 years, what's a grand, or what's 250 quid? Like, even if you get a refurb wrong by a couple of grand, it doesn't really matter ultimately.
Absolutely spot on, and this is something that a lot of people struggle with, as you say, when they're starting. It's good to crunch numbers, of course it's important, but that's where you have to know what your end goal is. If you're doing it for 10, 15, 20, 30 years as a wealth generational thing, then you know really the upfront cost of an extra couple of K is not, it's not a major thing.
I get the short-term pain is the biggest thing, because when you've got angels to pay and you've got people that you need to get money back to, then your back can feel a little bit against the wall when it comes to deals sometimes. But I think that when you put yourself in a situation, I think most people will come out strong. So we put ourselves in a situation a few times where we'd rather have something going through than nothing going through. So we'd pay a little bit more than we wanted, which meant that on the end val, let's say the end val comes down by $5,000 and there's nothing you can do about that, and you've got some money to pay back to an angel, you're scratching around different places to try and get that money back to them. Mm. But then it's done. It's finished. And time is probably the biggest healer of mistakes, isn't it? So it just let it run and let the rent run for a year and you'll probably get your money back anyway.
In terms of mistakes, it's very important. Would you, apart from what you just mentioned, what other mistakes do you think that you've made over the years that you've learned from and improved upon?
My first refurb, that was a shocker. I mean, my first refurb, when I talk about getting refurb prices wrong by a couple of grand, I got mine, I think I put about $4,000 or $5,000 in for a refurb. And we ended up spending 12, and my dad fit the kitchen. And we stripped out the whole property. It was an absolute car crash. But it's, I mean, numbers on that. Well, I bought it for 60K. I put in for a 4K refurb. And it valued at 80. So I bought that on credit cards and all that kind of stuff. So I couldn't pay everything back straight away. I had to take quite a high loan to value, which was 80%. Quite a good get out if you've got stuff to pay back. Now, the most recent index val on that, bearing in mind this is in the northeast of England, was $98,000. So it's gone up, and it's gone up quite considerably. A down val is only a short-term thing, so if it gets down valed, the next time it probably won't. So that kind of burgles you $5,000 or $10,000. But it's gone up a little bit in value as well, so that was 6 years ago now. Brilliant property. But made a lot of mistakes on the refurb. I should have taken a builder with me, but I read a book, so I thought I knew what I was doing. Just the one book.
Hey, we all make mistakes, but it's good to know. It's good to know because, you know, it's life, it's property. These things happen. You're not going to be 100% perfect all the time. And if you go in with that mentality, then, you know, you're probably not in the right place. It's good to want loads of things, but at the same time, you've got to have a dose of reality, i.e. shit will go wrong.
I think there's the whole kind of comparing yourself to others that a lot of people will talk about as well. There's so many variables when you're comparing yourself to somebody else, and I've been guilty of this, kind of especially as we got started. I'd look and say, we've bought 6 properties in our first year, but I could always find somebody that had bought 8 or 10, or they'd sourced $3 million in property and bought 8. And I just think you've really got to compare like for like. If you're going to compare like for like. Did they get a cash injection? Did they get help from family and friends? Did you start with no money from anybody, no family and friends to go to? Because that was us. We had zero money from family, zero money from friends. I was 22, Chris was 24, all of my friends were pissed around the world doing kind of Ibiza, all that kind of stuff, which is what you're meant to be doing at that age. But try raising finance from 24 and 25-year-olds isn't going to work. And for some reason, a 22-year-old raising finance off a 50-year-old looks like a high risk because you're really young. So there's those things you've got to compare like for like. If you really, really kind of need to compare for your own kind of self-awareness, whatever it is, make sure you're comparing apples with apples, because that's probably the biggest thing that I give myself a hard time with.
I think most people do. It's you know, the power of social media as well. It's very easy to portray something in a photo, or it's very easy to portray things with a few words, and it doesn't always, if you take it at face value, it might not always give the fair reflection of what's actually going on as you say, you know, have you had other investments? What's going on, you know?
I know people with thousands of followers on things like Instagram that allude to the fact that they're buying a lot of property. And I would never say who they are because it's not fair, but they'll come to me for, or Chris, they'll confide in one of us for advice on how to buy their second property, which is perfect and that's really cool. But I think it's really important that people don't maybe believe everything they see when it comes to that. One of our angel investors who's got 180 grand with us has got money with three other investors that talk on Instagram about how good they are at investing when they've owed her money for over a couple of years and they're going through proceedings to get it back. So you've got to be, and that sounds really catty that or really bitchy that you talk about stuff like that. And I would never ever say who they are, but just for people that are listening, just be really careful who you're measuring yourself against and be really careful who you're watching. I think you know over a period of time, don't you? If you watch somebody close enough and you can see how other established investors communicate with them, I think that's quite a big thing. Then you'll start to know who to start using as measuring sticks, I suppose you could say. Because it's good to have something to aim for. Just don't let it bury you.
Yeah, it's great advice as well. And, you know, we're not here to, you know, point out names or pick on people. That's not our style either. It's everyone to their own. If you do good ethical business with the best intentions, then, you know, you're always going to benefit somehow because it's that law of reciprocity. So, but it's I mean, again, that's interesting to hear those stories about that because, again, this sort of stuff goes on. And on social media, it's very easy to portray the opposite. So
those people could teach far more through some of their failings than they could from success. It's not really a good teacher, is it? Success. People like to see success, and I'll notice that I don't know Instagram and algorithms and all that kind of stuff, but I notice that if I post something with flashy numbers or nice numbers, there's a property there, this is what we bought it for, this is what we do, this is how much it's worth, people love it. If you give advice on using scrub mats at the front of a property and using light switches outside instead of pull cords, that's more valuable advice, but people are interested. Don't see your
number. Oh, that's just the society we live in, I think. Now, as you say, everyone loves to see the successes. They're not too bothered about the failures, but it's the failures that are what make us.
Yeah, exactly.
Annie, I think that's perfect. I suppose before we go into how people can get hold of you, etc., any other last pieces of advice, any nuggets of information you got there?
I think that one of the things that I would never regret doing it because it got us going, but we paid 24 grand for training, for property training, and it's helped me meet a lot of the people that I know now, which has been fantastic. That was 6 years ago now, and things have changed over the last 6 years when it comes to things like free content. So if you are looking at getting into property, there's so much free content on the internet, and there's so much free content on social media as well. I've done some Q&As on my Instagram on angels, and I did another one the other week on, I can't remember what it was, but it was how to get started in property. So those little things I would never have found 6 years ago because there didn't seem to be anybody on there. So I think before you heavily invest in something, look at what free content is out there. And I think reading as well. I think that a lot of people do it now, Audible, all that kind of stuff, but I've read hundreds of books over the last few years, and from somebody that didn't read a book ever, and I'm talking, I'd read maybe half of Harry Potter and I put it down because it was too long, to reading hundreds of books, there's so much education and there's so much wealth of experience out there that you can learn so much, but there's the kind of gap between learning so much and doing it as well. So you don't want to be a motivated idiot. You don't want to learn nothing and get involved. That's no good for anybody. But if you can learn a little bit, apply, learn a little bit, apply, learn a bit, then people will fly.
Totally agree with that. There's a lot of information out there, a lot of great content. Anthony, if people want to find out more about yourself, Chris, and Champ Properties, how do they do that?
So I'm fairly active on Instagram. I don't understand Instagram in terms of algorithms and all that shit, but I put stuff on and I get good feedback. So, and we get leads from it. We've got investors from it. So it's been a good platform for us in terms of marketing. So Instagram, I think it's just Anthony Hunter Property. Facebook, the website, so it's just Chant Properties, CHANT properties.co.uk. That's getting changed at the minute, so that's kind of under, I don't know what they call it, a renovation, a website renovation.
Yeah, construction renovation. People know what you mean. It's fine.
It was okay. It's getting better. So they're probably the main platforms. LinkedIn as well. Like, so you'll be able to find me just Anthony Hunter on LinkedIn. Should be fairly easy to get in touch with, I think.
Great stuff. And as usual, we'll put all the links in our show notes as well, so people can get hold of you easy. Anthony, just a massive thank you for your time and really, really great information today, and look forward to touching base in due course.
Yeah, thank you.